Well, Gary, I had some, I guess you could say, some concluding questions I'd like to ask you regarding the Constitution and some related topics. I guess probably the best place to start off would be, why has the United States of America been referred to as the Great Experiment?
Well, I guess we've got to look way back in history. There were republics in the past. There were different forms of government, Greek and Roman, throughout history. But for the most part, they were all led by a single entity. Caesar, kings, Europe, our background culture, Western Europe, was all kings. And so there was somebody in charge, a dictator, a king, somebody with absolute or near absolute power, final say on everything, just about. That changed over the years. The one I'm most familiar with would be England, the history of the English people. But still, it was never rested in the hands of the people. Now, when the founding fathers, now there was an English constitution. People say there's not, but there was, and I've got books on it. But it was a compilation of things from the Magna Carta forward. It's just things were attached as principle and adhered to, but they could be changed from time to time as well. But generally, there was a more benevolent attitude towards the people, but still nothing like a democracy where every member or every justified or warranted member of the society was a member participating in the government. And now we're going to hit that road that some military officer back in the 30s wrote something that was really incorrect, because democracy means the government controlled by the people. They're the source of authority in the government. A republic doesn't mean that. Plato's Republic didn't mean that. The old republics were, I don't think they were quite oligarchies, but there was a ruling class. They were the ones that were represented in the Senate in Rome, for example. The poor people, the people that grew the wheat and did the dirt work, they had no representation at all. So the founding fathers called it a Republican democracy or a democratic republic quite often in some of the early writings. Probably Hamilton was the first one to really separate the two, where he said it's a republic in the House of Representatives and it's a democracy where everybody has an equal vote in the Senate. Every state has an equal vote in the Senate. But so for the first time in the history, we the people, and we did that one on the Philadelphia conspiracy, but we the people, a bunch of people got together in Philadelphia. These were the wisdom of the day. Most of them had ventured out of politics. They started the Continental Congresses. They were there early on. I think Madison was the only one that was still in active government at the time. So the wisdom really settled in Philadelphia to design this new constitution. And so what they formed was something that was unique to the world. One, it had never been done before. And two, they sat down with a blank piece of paper, basically. There was the Virginia plan, there were a couple, New Jersey plan, a couple plans were proposed, but basically they started with a blank piece of paper and said, with what knowledge we have, knowledge of history, knowledge of our own experiences and everything, what form of government can we develop that basically would take away their power, because they were aristocracy at that point. And that was about the democratic part of it, where the people themselves, those deserving members of the society, were the elements that developed this government. So they created something the world had never seen before, and they were so really optimistic about the idea of having that blank sheet of paper and trying to create something that would last forever, that they put it together, the Great Seal, was it says a new order of things, no, whatever the Latin is. And they created a great experiment in whether man can be his own ruler. And when I say ruler, because the ruling came from the body of the people, the democratic aspect of that. So it is a great experiment. It affected 3 million people. It had to face the rest of the world and the military might of the rest of the world, which was challenged in 1812, to see whether it could survive under these new conditions they'd put together. And so as it began, they really had to play the roles to develop the power of the presidency. And, Washington did an excellent job of that, even keeping Hamilton and Jefferson in the cabinet, two guys completely at odds with each other, working together to achieve things. I mean, they didn't always work together, but so over the first, say, 20 years, this great experiment developed the operational skills. Let's look at it from a military standpoint. The strategy was the Constitution. The tactics were the administration of the Constitution. They developed the tactics by which this great nation would function. And as you know from habeas corpus, especially when we look back at what occurred until the Civil War, that it was a wonderful experiment. And so it was a great experiment. It worked.
Well, has the intention of the framers been fulfilled by the government's adherence to the Constitution then?
Well, there was adherence, I think I just mentioned it, from 1789 to 1861, there was a rigid adherence to the Constitution. There were experiments, working out the details and all that, but there was adherence. But the Civil War changed things, and with the Civil War, there was deviation in the creation of West Virginia, for example, in a direct, blatant violation of the Constitution, which would have required the consent of the Virginia legislature to create West Virginia. Then we had the 14th Amendment taking away from the states the prerogative of determining who can be citizens within that state. Subsequently, we had the 15th Amendment, which prior to that time, the states determined who could vote, and who could vote in the presidential election was predicated on who could vote within that state for the most numerous house. But the federal government took that away from them with the 15th Amendment. Subsequently, we had women's vote, 18-year-old vote, get rid of the poll tax. And so the government has taken over areas that were preserved for the states for their own autonomy as members of the union rather than subordinates to the federal government. So the deviation, the lack of adherence to the Constitution began then and really hasn't stopped since then.
Well, was the Constitution intended to be a model for the rest of the world?
There were the thinkers back then, Jefferson one of them, probably spoke most of it, they felt that it could be a model for the world, not a one-world government, but a model for the Western European nations who had kings. England wasn't too much later began revising their form of government to right now the Queen is the figurehead, the Prime Minister is almost the President. Most of the European nations up through World War II had gone that way, even after, but they've become socialized. Oh, we have too, come to think of it. But they thought that this experiment, this great experiment, would become a model for the rest of the world, not be jammed down their throats like we try and do today, but by the good that was achieved here, which is true back in the 1800s for the most part, that other people would begin to adopt a similar form of government. So, yes, a model for the rest of the world. No, not a mandate to the rest of the world, but, if it works, people will pick it up.
So, does the Constitution place rulers over us?
We have gotten in the habit of calling them our leaders, and I hate to hear that. They're our employees. They are representatives of the people. Of course, they have secured power unto themselves. The presidency has really gone amok in this last administration, where but it's been progressive that presidents have gone beyond their authority. Really, the first one was Andrew Jackson. He wrote back that he was not going to enforce one aspect of one law. I don't recall which one it was right now, but he laid out very clearly his reasons for not enforcing it. There's no reason given for not enforcing immigration laws now. It's just an arbitrary act of the president. So it began with Jackson in the 1830s. But at this point, it's become absurd that they have, in essence, assumed a role of rulership over us. But Congress does it by passing laws that take from our pockets and give to their friends, and the president does it with greater authority than even George III had in England back in 1776. So they have become rulers, though it was never intended to be such.
Is the Constitution's enumerated power to suppress insurrection contradict the Declaration of Independence, specifically the right of revolution?
Well, let's look at some of the insurrections. Shays' Rebellion, the Civil War, and there have been other insurrections, minor ones, that have been put down in the 30s, the strikes and things like that. But the insurrections can be put down by whom? The militia, right?
I think that's what happened with the Whiskey Rebellion, which took place after the
Oh,
ratification.
whiskey, wh right, Whiskey Rebellion, yeah. But the militia suppresses insurrection. Now, the Civil War, the army put down insurrection, but remember, Lincoln said the Union is not dissolved and it's still intact. And he wanted to get the bad people out that were leading the other people astray, basically. But it's supposed to be the militia only that puts down insurrection. In a sense, you could look at the army, the Union army that was created during the war, almost as a militia, because they had to bring all these civilians in. The initial ones that went in were doing it to preserve the Union.
I'm trying to make sense of this insurrection clause where it essentially says that the militia of the several states can go and suppress insurrections and repel invasions, but then in the Declaration of Independence, the people have a right to alter or abolish the government. So I don't quite see how it's possible that if the people want to abolish the government, how they can go about doing that if the militia can just simply suppress what they would incorrectly consider to be an insurrection or repelling an invasion of some kind.
Okay, so let's who comprises the militia?
And should be the people themselves.
Okay, so let's suppose, just like in the 1770s, enough people say, you know, something wrong with government. I think we got to go back to the Declaration of Independence. Government finds out about that, and these people start arming themselves, and the government says, okay, we're calling forth the militia. Now, let me back up a little. About 1912 or 1913, the United States militia was created. Before then, it was all states militia, so they were going to call the militia from the states, and I think it's clear in the Constitution that they call the state militias into national service. But even with the United States militia, so the president puts out, with the authority of Congress, presumably declaring there is an insurrection, puts out a call: all militia report to Washington, D.C. immediately. You have 24 hours to get here. And everybody says, fuck you, screw you. So now the people then, the militia has opted to stay on the other side of the fence and restore the government. So is it a violation of the Constitution? Maybe, but does the Constitution require they have to respond to a call from a government that they think has become tyrannical? So, you know, we get into, let's say, Lockean philosophy now, chapter 19, dissolution of government. If the people perceive the government has dissolved itself by its And this is, quite frankly, this is where I believe we are right now, that the government has dissolved itself under the lock-in criteria, that we have every right now, because it's become tyrannical for the reason stated. The president's a ruler now. He's a dictator, and he's not even, he's got more power than King George III have. Congress could care less. They don't do anything. Well, look at current events, the Iran nuclear deal. He's trying to keep from Congress from even being able to object to it. Medicare, or the health care bill. It's tyrannical. It's a battle between them over public relations on who's going to look good when they do something without any regard for us. So we've reached that tyranny. So let's suppose the government decided to call forth the militia now to put down insurrection because a bunch of the militia people said, screw you, and started the insurrection. Then the remainder of the militia people have to go into insurrection or go to the government. So we're in the same position we were there. What if more people opted to be Tories and less, let's say, Americans? If they chose to be Tories, well, we'll use the term of the time, Whigs. If more had decided to become Tories than Whigs, then the insurrection against England would have been put down pretty quickly, wouldn't it? So, in a sense, it's a vote of the people, a vote of the will of the people, whether we opt for the dissolution of government, i.e., the Declaration of Independence, or accept submissive obedience to the federal government. The same choices they had then. So there is no difference. One's the emergency escape valve. That's called the Declaration of Independence.
Well, I mean, if that's the case, then according to classical liberalism, which is John Locke is considered the father of, if it is indeed according to classical liberalism that the government has dissolved itself, then that would mean that there is no government right now. Therefore, whatever it is that calls itself the government would be, I guess, to invoke the words of Murray Rothbard, nothing more than a banded gang writ large.
Basically, that's it. Now, Locke did not address the military aspects of dissolution of government. He discussed only the philosophical aspects of it. So the manifestation of the physical aspects were demonstrated by the people that responded to the philosophical aspects in the 1770s.
Well, speaking about the 1770s and kind of leading into the 1780s then, were the predictions of the Federalists more accurate than those of the Anti-Federalists?
Well, I don't like the terms Federalist and Anti-Federalist. The Anti-Federalists didn't call themselves the Anti-Federalists. The Federalists called them the Anti-Federalists. But the Anti-Federalists were more Federalist, Federation-oriented than the Federalists, weren't they?
Yeah, I think so. I think the fellows who were promoting the ratification of the federal constitution who called themselves the Federalists were more, well, I know some people I've associated with over the years would call them outright authoritarian, but maybe that's a little too harsh a term.
So, understanding the Federalists were not Federalists, and the Anti-Federalists were Federalists, we'll stick to the nomenclatures that have become commonly used, even though improper. So, we'll proceed with the question. The Federalist predictions. If we adhered to the Constitution, that's the Federalist side. There wouldn't be any problems right now. We've discussed that. We've deviated from the Constitution for 160 years, 150 years. So there's nothing wrong with what the Federalists said. Is there a problem with what the Anti-Federalists did? They wanted a little more assurance. And let's look at the necessity of that insurance, the freedom of speech. Freedom of religion's going by the wayside. Well, we've discussed this in the previous. On the Bill of Rights, but the right to keep and bear arms. What if we didn't have a Bill of Rights now, and the government, since they control the army and the militia and the general welfare and the Commerce Clause and all these things, said you can't have guns anymore? So there's no doubt that the Bill of Rights enumerating certain rights, now the 9th and 10th don't count anymore. In fact, what we discussed the other night, all of them have basically been subordinated to federal authority. So the Anti-Federalists were right, and the Federalists were right. If there was adherence to the Constitution, we would be fine. To have the additional assurances laid out by the Anti-Federalists, look at how well they've come into play lately in dealing with the government that's trying to quash all of them. Those enumerated are not being attacked like other ones have. Marriage is not enumerated. The federal government's taken that over. Emotions, hate crimes, the government's taken that over. I don't see in the Constitution where that's there. They're just making things up. But the ones enumerated in the Bill of Rights are right now acting as a pretty strong buffer against the incorporation doctrine. But you can't say the Federalists were wrong, and you can't say the Anti-Federalists were wrong, because the composite was the great experiment. So the concerns the Anti-Federalists have been manifest. So in a sense, from a philosophical standpoint, the Anti-Federalists being skeptical about what happens when you give people power, they were probably more correct than the Federalists, who tended to assume that it would work the way they wrote it. Does that answer the question?
I think at least partially. I mean, perhaps it would be better if we looked at like certain elements, certain types of topics. I mean, let's take taxation for instance. I remember some of the anti-federalists. I don't recall which ones right offhand. Basically, considered excise taxes to be downright tyrannical. Yet in Article 1, Section 8, if I remember correctly, in the taxing and spending clause. Excise taxes are constitutional, unquestionably. So, for someone back then during the ratification period of the 1780s, essentially screaming bloody murder about something that has since then been unquestionably constitutional, it seems that I don't know they really have in some ways are more patriotic than many of those in the patriot community today, in one sense.
Well, let's look at a couple aspects of it. First, taxation is a rather broad term because it in terms includes duties and tariffs and things like that, right? But when we look at an excise tax, if we look to a Federalist, Mr. Hamilton, when he said commerce is the primary beneficiary of the military force that we have, which was primarily Navy at the time, because anything exported left this country. I mean, we didn't have a lot of dealings with Mexico, and we had a little with Canada, but not that many. Most of our trade was with Europe. So the Navy, this enormous Navy that we retained, and it was not limited like the Army was, had to exist and had to be paid for. Now, should you or I pay for it, or should the commercial interests, who are in a better position to pay for it? Now, they'll pass it on to us, there's no doubt about that. But the distribution of it and the collection of it would be a lot easier if the excise for, say, somebody that's exporting things, it broadened too. When the government needed money, they taxed alcohol, and unfortunately, the people didn't have cash to pay it. But the government's got to have a way to have the revenue to operate government. Now, back then, the operation of government wasn't expensive unless we were at war. So there are different elements, and we'll get into that. But when we look at the state conventions, at least five states asked about the direct tax. Now, that's the one that concerns me. If I do have an excise tax, say I manufacture firearms, and they have an excise tax on that. That gives the government some money to buy some firearms with for the soldiers, right? The more recent ones that didn't exist back then would be like the gasoline, the batteries, and tire excise tax. Well, that money went into the Federal Highway Transportation Trust Fund. So back then, usually there was a designated purpose. They didn't have this concept of general funding we have today. So an excise tax, with few exceptions, would generally go to the purpose from which the tax evolved or developed. But back to the direct tax, at least five states in their state conventions ratifying the Constitution asked about the direct tax, and they were told it would only be applied in an emergency. And for the most part, it was, because apparently income until World War II was pretty much unearned income. If you had stocks, some of the classic tax cases talks about stocks and the profit from the stocks. You know, if you rent a building out, you're not really earning that. So it's the unearned income that was taxed until World War II. And then in World War II, the Liberty Tax, they started taxing everybody, but everybody was willing to pay what was necessary to defeat the Japanese and the Germans. So if the taxes stayed in their original constraints, and they didn't, the creative people in Congress didn't come up with this idea of general funding, and what general funding allows is tens of trillions of dollars from the Federal Highway Transportation Trust Fund and tens of trillions of dollars from the Social Security Trust Fund, all these monies far exceeding, perhaps approaching $100,000 or $100 trillion, far exceeds what they tell us the debt is, which is 16 or 17 trillion. But what we did with that is we gave them an unlimited coffer. Now, kings had trouble. When they wanted to wage war, they had to either have the money in the chests, or they had to borrow the money. Our government doesn't have to do that to declare war, and they've done it from Korea on. They just reach into their coffers. Their coffers run dry. They reach into our pockets. They create more money and all that. So all these are deviations from the intent. But if we went back strictly to the operation of government without the fourth branch of government, the taxes you wouldn't even notice them. When you distribute that between 320 million people, probably $10 a year per person would be sufficient, collected probably through excise but ideally imposed or duties, because that's the commerce, the international trade. But since we don't export anything anymore except wars, it's kind of hard to collect tax on soldiers going overseas. So it's been bastardized. But the right to tax has to exist, because let's suppose they created the government and disregard the fact that the debt that they had then was tens of millions of dollars that we'd borrowed for the Revolutionary War. So we've got a government. Are these people going to work for free? Maybe the elected people was. Franklin suggested they receive no salary and they should be people of wealth. That was, you know, a degree only that wasn't adopted. But even if the representatives and the president were willing to work for free, what about the secretaries? What about the other people that have to administer these the government? How are they going to get paid without taxes? How does your city operate without taxes? How does your county operate without taxes? How does your state? There's got to be a source of funding. If you live in a commune, you've got to put your share in. So any system you're in, you know, let's go back, say, 80 years in this country, especially during the Depression. If the kid could go out and make 50 cents a week, he would, and he'd throw it in the family kitty because we've got to eat. So taxation is a necessity. The practicality of taxation is an absolute in any form of government. There's got to be a means of revenue to pay the expenses of government. So the question comes in not on where it comes from and how much comes in. What matters more than anything is how much goes out, and that's where the government has gone overboard, and they have become philanthropists for the world. So the problem is really on the other side, not the taxation side. When they, 1913, when they enacted the 16th and 17th Amendments, for example, the surplus in the United States Treasury was $100 million, if I remember correctly. Well, how could they have $100 million in the bank? Well, they didn't have any place to spend it. They were only paying the necessary expenses of government. But those necessary expenses of government have gone far beyond the concept ever envisioned by the Founding Fathers. So the The problem is, if we're going to restore constitutional government, it's just like, a family. You get a credit card and they keep raising your limit and you keep going to the limit. That's not the way to operate. But the government has done so well at it that businesses do it and families do it now. They spend what they don't have. And we've got to get back to, if you want to buy something, you save the money up and then buy it. Even a layaway plan, but you don't sell your future for your present. So taxation is necessary, but the application of taxation has to be keyed with the application of spending, and then it's just. Under the current circumstances, it's absolutely unjust.
Well, I don't know about that. The federal farmer asserted that direct taxation was inherently not representative at all in Anti-Federalist Paper 39. Patrick Henry declared that concurrent taxation, that is both state and federal tax collection, is at odds with American liberty in Anti-Federalist Paper 34. And the fellow that I was trying to remember from earlier, his pseudonym was Cato Uticensis. He hated excise taxes, going even so far as calling them, quote, "those instruments of tyranny," end quote. And he asked in a tone of righteous indignation whether any of his fellow Virginians would ever live to see the day where a government other than the Virginia General Assembly would ever impose a direct tax in Virginia, Anti-Federalist Papers 30 and 31. So as far as taxation goes, it seems like the founders in the two factions in question that you and I are discussing this evening seem to really kind of go back and forth as to whether or not to tax, and if to tax, and what ways to tax, and all that. So, I mean, I'm not completely convinced.
Well, let's look at that. You talked about Cato, whatever his last name was, and these other people. Did they offer, or are they Lysander Spooners, or did they offer an alternative for the revenues that are necessary for the conduct of government, the proper conduct of government?
No, I don't remember any
So.
sort of proposed solutions on their part. They were pretty much just critiquing the federal constitution as
Right, so
proposed.
the federal constitution has, and we're going to leave direct taxes out for a moment. The idea then is and there was probably that diversity in the discussions in the convention. A lot of it wasn't recorded. So if we've got a plate of four or five different things, then the majority can pick which method. And as that majority changes and picks another method, the method of taxation, tariffs, duties, excise can shift back and forth, depending on good administration, just like you would apply in a house or in a business, not in a modern sense, but back then. But let's go to direct taxes. The problem with not having the ability to do the direct taxes to offset a major expense on the part of government is keyed to another element in 1-8, which is only Congress can declare war. So if the representatives of the people decide to declare war, then who's going to fund the war? The representatives have said the people want a war, therefore we're going to war. How are we going to pay for the war? Now, back to what I said earlier, in the constitutional conventions, the Federalists told the conventions that they will be only be used in an emergency, and that emergency then obviously would be we're going to add a great expense to operation of government by going to war. And so, how do we pay that off? And so we tax to do it until it's paid off. Once the emergency situation is gone, then you go back to the previous condition. Otherwise, let's say we're invaded, and the government, what are they going to do? Go out and borrow no money from foreign nations like we did during the Revolutionary War? And then we're going to have to pay that back. So what effect is that going to have on the government? And eventually it's going to come out of the pocket of the people somehow anyway, or the government's going to go bankrupt because it can't pay its bills. So there's no alternative than to have a method to maintain government, excise, impost, duties. And direct tax when there's a surge in expense. And that generally would only, the only thing that would cause something like that would be a war, which is very expensive, and a country can 20-fold their expense by going to war. Because they hire all these people, they have to equip them, they have to transport them, they have to feed them. They become family. Everything, their diapers have to be paid for by the government. So you got to have a source for that. But they're doing it because the representatives of the people said, we do have an emergency. We need to go to war, either offensively or defensively. But it's the will of the people that allows that declaration of war. So one guy can be opposed to excise tax. I've got a friend that doesn't think corporations should be taxed, but what he doesn't grasp is corporations are created by government and they're insulated from, they used to be, I don't know if they are anymore, what was called the corporate shield. So they're protected against lawsuits in excess of their value and all kinds of things. But see, everybody's got an opinion, so they left three things on the table for the primary source of revenue: excise, impost, duties. And then the will of the people, as designated by the representatives of the people, determine which one of those is going to be used primarily, secondarily, and tertiarily to offset the expense of government. How else can you do it, Lysander Spooner?
Well, it's interesting you bring up war and the military. I know, it kind of reminds me, you know, there was one anti-federalist known as the Democratic Federalist who objected to the centralization of the militia. That was an anti-federalist paper 29. And similarly, a federal Republican, not to be confused with the previous fella, somebody different, stated the obvious that standing armies such as consolidated militias could be used to stifle revolts. That was anti-federalist paper 8. So I guess the question at that point would be, you know, would the militias of the several states be the same thing as a standing army then, or was a federal Republican just incorrect in that assumption of his?
Okay, well, maybe he didn't read very closely. Let's look at militia in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15, to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the land. It's the national police force if the need arises. I don't know the circumstances they anticipated, but as long as the government doesn't go outside their realm and sticks within the enumerated powers, what happens if they've got to have a means to enforce their laws. To execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrection, very specific, suppress insurrection, that's the one we just talked about, and repel invasion. That's calling forth the militias. What else? Where else do we find? To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, this is 1816. Reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers and the authority of training militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. Okay, next we have Article 1, Section 2. The President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states. Remember I said there's no such thing as U.S. militia. Of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. Now, see, to call them in, he has to satisfy the conditions that were set out in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15, enforce the laws of the United States, suppress insurrection, and repel invasion. So we've got a limiting. We don't have a standing army with the militia. The beauty of it is it's not a standing army. Now, Civil War, people came in for 6 months service initially. The federal people came in for a term of 6 months, and the 6 months people hadn't even recovered from Bull Run when their 6 months was expiring. So people were leaving the service after one battle. And they never had to come back in because the government thought the war was going to be over in 6 months. But they're called and they do it. Now, if they want to go back and plant their crops, which happened during the Revolutionary War, they just leave. And even though the military discipline required that they serve, I don't know of any instance where the militia was punished for going home and planting crops or taking care of family. The regulars did. So the militia, being that standing army, is not a standing army because, as we talked about with the insurrection versus Declaration of Independence, they're going to take the side that they want to take. So, what is wrong with militia in that respect?
Well, you mentioned a moment ago about the president being the commander-in-chief. You know, that's rather interesting because Philadelphiensis expressed a deep suspicion that the president was, in effect, an elective king of the very worst sort. And more to the point, because the president of the United States of America is the commander-in-chief of what would presumably be a standing army, which, of course, as you pointed out, is not exactly correct. But if he was the commander-in-chief of a standing army, the president's power would not be limited, and thus, you know, calling the government under the Constitution as some sort of republic would be a contradiction. So I guess that's kind of what I'm trying to get at. Would the president's duty as the commander-in-chief be evidence that his power is not limited at all?
If they go outside the constraints of the Constitution, let's go back to Article 2, Section 2. The President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and the Navy of the United States. Now, the Navy back then was the primary defense of the country because we were rather isolated from Western Europe, from Europe and Asia and everything, and to protect commerce. I mean, we've got, you know, the Barbary Pirates is a good example of the need for the Navy. Now, the Navy also, and the reason the Marines are in the Navy is, what kid is a Navy if they can't get off the ship and fight, you know? So the Marines was really an extension of the Navy that could go on the ground to recover prisoners or goods or things like that, to aboard a vessel during a battle, things like that. The Army, the limitation was 2 years in the Constitution. Now, I enlisted for what amounted to a total of 8 years, I think. Maybe it was six. I served 3.5 active. I was supposed to go National Guard after Vietnam, but I didn't. So the idea of a standing army did not exist even after World War II. After World War I, you know, after the war, they went back to a very small, but we never went without a standing army because with the Western movement, the military was necessary to protect the people moving west against Indian attacks, whatever problems might arise out there, and to protect the borders of the United States, which they had to do with the Canadian border on a couple occasions. So even though they said no standing armies, they realized the necessity of a small force that had to be effective against current threats. And so we've always had that. But it wasn't until even after World War II, Truman arranged, and a lot of people left the military. Now, it stayed larger, but, you know, it was really winding down from World War II by the time Korea started. Now, it was since Korea then that we've managed to escalate the size of the army and keep it up. So it was fairly large. It went up again for Vietnam. It went down a little. But we've had larger numbers since then. But we've also got a deviation from the Constitution because the standing army should not be capable of fighting a war. They should be capable of providing the protections that are necessary for any country. No country can exist without an army. It can't. But it's when the army's in place to work on the civilians that you have a problem. And that's, remember, they just come out of that. The British in Boston, the British in New York, the British in Charleston, the British Philadelphia for a period of time, the British in parts of New Jersey for a time. The standing army was constantly there, and it was oppressing the people. So the concept of no standing army was a reactive one, but the necessity for an army sufficient to meet the needs of the defense of the country immediately, then being backed up by the militia, and then being enlarged as necessary to conduct war, was the concept that was in mind of the people that wrote the Constitution, because there were those that didn't want a standing army, and those that, the more practical ones, realized the necessity of having an army in place for certain functions. So it's a balancing act, and one person's opinion doesn't override the majority. and the decisions in Philadelphia were made by a majority, and they were also made by the wisdom. These guys were, like I said earlier, they were out of politics, but they were the wisdom. They had the experience. They've been dealing with this for, you know, 20 years or so. And so were their decisions wiser than the knee-jerk of some guy writing for a newspaper? Probably so. And did they probably weigh those out when they were making their considerations? Probably so. Even though the details of the convention Madison wrote were not that detailed, when you do read them, you can see that some of the issues that were addressed were going back and forth, trying to find the perfect fit. And so we have to assume that these other ones that aren't addressed more specifically were equally discussed, but just somebody didn't feel that it was worth recording the debate that ensued on those subjects.
Well, it's interesting you bring up, you know, the issues with the various Indian peoples and westward expansion. I think Patrick Henry tried to rebut the claim that the proposed federal government would require a standing army in order to curtail the potential emergence of foreign invasions, internal rebellions, and even Indian wars. The way that Henry saw it was that he saw these justifications for war preparations as mere Federalist propaganda, and that was an anti-Federalist paper 4. I mean, do you think Patrick Henry was maybe just being a little bit overly cautious then?
Well, two things about Patrick Henry. It wasn't for until 1861 that we saw the manifestation of what he perceived was going to be a constant problem, right?
Probably.
70 years. So I think 70 years, three generations, is sufficient to allay his concerns. If he had survived through that period and observed it, I think he would have reconsidered. However, let's look at Patrick Henry again. He was probably the first and most pronounced opponent of the Constitution, said, well, it's been ratified, and we're going to make the best of it. So he realized that the majority had overruled him, and he accepted the decision of the majority, and he backed it 100% at that point. We all have opinions, just like these other people that write for newspapers under whatever name they write under. They've got their opinions. They've got a right to it. Is theirs truth because they said it, or is theirs truth because you want to believe it? You know, we're back to that same thing that we deal with today on the Internet. Is it a truth because you want to believe it, or is it a truth because it is really a truth? So, you know, the powers that be, the wisdom of this country, the great wisdom of this country, resolve them in the form of the Constitution, including the concessions on slavery and census, that they were the best that could be afforded at the time and under the circumstances. If they had air conditioning, I think we would have done a little better because towards the end of the convention, everybody just wanted to go home. It had been hot for months, and the committee of I can't think of their name now, the ones that put the final wording on it, kind of changed a few things a little bit and probably weighted them towards the Federalist side a little bit. But still, the document itself, Patrick Henry said, I'll defend it now. You know, it's passed. So what is right, what is wrong? Now, we've got, you know, a couple centuries of experience, too. And so if we do restore constitutional government, I think we've got to revisit a lot of the what I think in many cases are quite clear elements of the Constitution, but expound upon them to show what the limits are and where they can't cross the line. And that could go to taxes too. For example, direct taxes, it should be defined in the Constitution, not just by voice to at least five of the states, that only in an emergency, and maybe to the point of saying what the emergency is. Expenditures of the United States, is it good for the general welfare for us to send hundreds of billions of dollars to countries around the world? Some of them are known enemies. You know, there should be, they didn't anticipate how corrupted the Constitution would become in those two centuries.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned about the Constitution getting corrupted. I mean, one of the, or probably the most important thing that the Anti-Federalists pushed for that they did get as a concession from their opponents was a Bill of Rights. You know, Brutus suggested that that the lack of a Bill of Rights, which would enumerate limits on government power against individual citizens, might very well be indicative of a massive power grab. That was Anti-Federalist Paper 84. And someone else called A. Farmer argued that such a Bill of Rights would limit the amount that congressmen would be able to borrow on the credit of the United States, Anti-Federalist Paper 13. Obviously, A. Farmer turned out to be incorrect, I think, as anyone who's looked at the national debt during, I don't know, the past 2, 3 decades or so can attest to. But I could have sworn Alexander Hamilton in, I think it was Federalist Paper 84, 85, somewhere in there, basically claimed that the Constitution proper, you know, the first several articles and such, were a Bill of Rights, as
Because they
opposed to
limited the
amendments.
powers and authorities, yes. But I think he was wrong. And if it, like I said just a little while ago, if it wasn't for the First and Second Amendment, where would we be today? Because Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, the Supremacy Clause, is so ambiguous. Now, it does say the aforementioned powers. And any other powers necessary for the conduct of government, something to that effect. So the ambiguity, and see, those are the things that need to be straightened out. I mean, there should be a line, a more rigid line, because that line, if we draw the line where it was drawn for that first 60, 70 years, and stayed within the constraints of those limitations on power and authority, there would be no problem. But power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we've achieved the absolute state in administration of power with a total disregard for the Constitution. And the words are quite clear in many cases. The spending power, let me find that real quick. To borrow money on the credit of the United States to regulate, to see, to where is it? Shall have the power to lay taxes and collect, to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Oh, is that a limit? It was then. Is that a limit now? Hell no. How can you possibly say that general welfare includes foreign aids? What about millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute? That concept is gone. We're paying our enemies. The Barbary pirates—they wanted us to pay this tribute to them, or they're going to raid our ships. And Jefferson says, "Screw you." So, if we look at what was, it was good. But the fact that the government has assumed that they're to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare—I'm not sure. Maybe they're saying, pay the debts, and broadening that phrase right there and saying, well, we created a debt by telling these people we'd pay them, and now we got to pay them. I don't know how they're twisting this, distorting it to the extent that, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars or perhaps trillions of dollars is going out of our hands. I mean, a country to function, and this is why I like Donald Trump. He's a businessman. And he knows you've got to have a balance of trade. If you're buying things and selling things, there's got to be a balance. You can't buy things if you don't sell things. You can't sell things if you don't buy things. Because, you know, the other side wants to buy and sell too. So the imbalance of trade that we've had for decades is destructive of an economy. And throw into that the fact that we're just throwing money overseas without consideration of trade at all, that the fiscal responsibility that government's supposed to have is non-existent at this point. They're philanthropists. And they don't, like a philanthropist, they don't have the money to give to people. They just pass that debt on to our children, our posterity. Who knows how many generations. Right now, as the debt appears and as the way the government functions, that debt can never be paid off. They're paying interest only, basically, on it. And they're accumulating additional debt on top of that. And that's the $16 trillion. That's the stuff that's being added to each year that can't be paid off. So, you know, if we stayed within the intent of the Constitution, we'd be fine. But we've deviated for a century and a half from that. So the Constitution is good, the government is bad, and it's become tyrannical. And now we're back to what they call it, the Declaration of Independence, the Lockean theory of dissolution. We're there. And the solution then is to come back and look at the Constitution very closely, draw some lines in it, maybe make some other significant changes. One would be right now the House can punish the House, the Senate can punish the House and Senate can punish the judiciary or the executive branch by impeachment, but the people have no control over any of those except at the next election cycle. And so there's, you know, they're missing one great thing, and that would be a means of the people to challenge the government or an official in government to hold him responsible to the obedience, because we've given all that, even though we've got separation of powers, that's disappeared. We've got courts making laws, we've got presidents ignoring laws, and we've got Congress passing laws that favor their friends, not the people, but their friends, the corporations.
Well, you know, something that I'd noticed in both the Federalist and Anti-Federalist Papers when I read them a while back was the issue of the Commerce Clause was actually a very big deal. Just right offhand, you know, Agrippa argued that the Interstate Commerce Clause was in fact an unlimited power of Congress. That was Anti-Federalist Paper 11. So, and it's interesting, Agrippa's observation about that. In fact, actually, you know, some experiences you've been having fairly recently with some American patriots apparently being created into political prisoners seem to kind of stem from the Commerce Clause being used in a way that would seem to be unlimited.
Well, let's look at some of the one of the ones I did on Massey, federal gun laws and the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause was intended, and it says it in the actually, I don't have the quote in this article, I don't think, but going back to the Federalist Papers, looking at, no, I don't have it in the article. If we go back to Federalist Papers, the Commerce Clause, the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with Indian tribes, but I don't have that other quote. Oh, wait, here it is. James Madison, FP 42. The defective power in the existing Confederacy to regulate the commerce between its several states is in the number of those which have been clearly pointed out by experience. To the proofs and remarks which former papers have brought into view on the subject, it may be added that without this supplemental provision, the great and essential power of regulating foreign commerce would have been incomplete and ineffectual. The very material object of this power was the relief of the states which import and export through other states from their improper contributions levied on them by the latter. So an internal state or a state that had to go through a larger shipping port to sell goods was at the mercy of the state with the port. Were these liberties to regulate the trade between state and state, it must be foreseen that ways would be found out to load the articles of import and export during the passage through their jurisdictions with duties which would fall on the makers of the latter and the consumers of the former. We may be assured by past experience that such a practice would be introduced by future contrivances, and both by that and common knowledge of human affairs, that it would nourish unceasing animosities and not improbably terminate in serious interruptions of the public tranquility. So by that Federalist Papers 42, it's very clear that the Commerce Clause is to avoid inequities in foreign commerce, in interstate commerce, and in trade with the Indian tribes. it does not go to intrastate. And, you know, in this most recent article, we're talking about intrastate. It does not affect intrastate, but the federal government has brought it into intrastate. Not inter, but intra, within the state. So they've expanded the authority. And we kind of first see it being admittedly used to correct social evils in 1934 with the original Gun Control Act, where the extent of their authority at the time was to tax the interstate transportation of firearms. To tax it, not to penalize it, but to punish it, I should say, but to tax it. So they're using the taxing power and the Commerce Clause to effect a social change, which is the control of guns with gangsters who have been imprisoned under felony convictions. Now, what's happened to that is we're out of taxes. Waco, $200 tax on an automatic rifle, if there were any. They went down there and killed all those people rather than collect a $200 tax on the firearms. The BATF initially was under the Treasury Department. So when the government abuses the intent of a law to the point that they use the Commerce Clause rather than to create a balance and a fairness or an equity, to use it punitively, they've deviated from the intent of the from the Commerce Clause as described by James Madison, haven't they?
Possibly.
Possibly. I think it goes beyond that. It was to avoid one state being able to take advantage of another state. I think he said that pretty clearly, because the burden falls on one and the gain on the other. So how does that get stretched out to the fact that they're using it now, first to use a punitive taxation to control firearms to a point of making it a five-year per weapon punitive incarceration for having a weapon that did not, during the term of its ownership by the person possessing it, travel in interstate commerce. And, I mean, to enforce the absurdity of that, based on the 18 U.S. Code 922G1, that if you live in a state that manufactures a firearm, you can own the firearm under that law, 922G1. If it manufactures ammunition, you can own the ammunition because it never traveled interstate. It's always been intrastate. If you live in a state that only manufactures firearms but not ammunition, you can have the firearm, but you can't have the ammunition, because the firearm's intrastate and the ammunition is interstate. If your state manufactures ammunition but not firearms, you can have all the ammunition you want. If you live in a state that doesn't manufacture firearms or ammunition, you can't have either if you're a felon. All of these condition on if you're a felon, according to the way the government currently is interpreting 922G1. And there's an absurdity. Where's the equity in that? That some people can own guns and others can't if they're felons? And others can own guns without ammunition, and others can own ammunition without a gun. We got four classes of people. There's no equity in that. They're all part of the same United States of America. So if we take that back just to the Commerce Clause, at best, they could only, like they did in 1934, they could only penalize it when it crossed that state line. So if it crossed that state line, whoever received it or whoever sent it would pay a tax, 1934. Once it got into the other state, now it goes into intrastate commerce, and anybody can buy it. That's the way it was in 1934. That's the way I believe it still is when I read 922G1, but they have made it a way of punishing people. So the Commerce Clause, the intent is clear. Equity. And what do they do with it now? They make it inequitable, depending on what state you live in, whether you can or cannot own ammunition and or firearms. So clearly they've deviated from the intent as laid out by Madison, haven't they?
I'm not a lawyer. I don't pretend to play one on TV or anywhere else for that matter, but I don't know. It just doesn't sit well with me. I mean, I'm sure the framers meant well in terms of facilitating trade and such. It's just that you look as time has passed, and even if there are theoretical limits on paper, I think the reality of the situation really kind of testifies to how effective those limits have been, at least at least with some of these clauses, Commerce Clause specifically.
Well, let's revisit what I've said a couple of times. What we need to do is go back and draw some lines on these things, because the lines were there. Even in 1934, they were there, even though they were applying it to a social problem, not an equity problem between states. But at least then, they stuck to the confines of the Commerce Clause and the Tax Clause. Now they've gone from that to make it a criminal thing. You can't pay the tax if you're a felon in possession. And it can be an intrastate. So the Commerce Clause needs to be expounded upon to draw the lines. That's it. The intention was there when it was drawn up, and Madison made it clear. But the intention was not written in black and white to the point that these damned high-paid government attorneys can't twist those words into mean something else. And the congressmen that support that doing it because they want to stop necessary evils. A lot of this comes as a consequence of the civil rights acts of the 1960s, because when you give a civil right to one, you have taken a right away from another. And that's exactly where we are with this, that whole concept. And so redefinition of things, clarification of a lot of the elements of the Constitution, and it would probably double the words to do that. But it needs to be done if we want to get back to the great experiment that worked for that first 60, 70 years. I mean, to me, the intent of the Commerce Clause is quite clear as intended by the founders. There is no question. Madison told us, 1934 even told us. But what we see now isn't close to either of those. They have made it a malo prohibita. And it's not supposed to be a malo prohibita. That's one of your favorite phrases, isn't it? Malo prohibita.
I do mention it in my articles and interviews and such because these victimless crimes, so-called, which is a wonderfully Orwellian phrase, I mean, yeah, it's basically that which is prohibited by the state, not because it actually causes injury or someone gets injured or becomes a victim, but because, the state said so. But I think probably the last topic, as far as this overall question of, were the predictions of the Federalists more accurate than those of the Anti-Federalists, would be the topic about checks and balances and separation of powers. For instance, Cato judged that limited government must be geographically small, and so he thought that the proposed Constitution negated the utility for a consolidated federal republic. That was Anti-Federalist Paper 14. Brutus considered the necessary and proper clause in Article 1, Section 8 to be indicative of a centralized, not dual, system of federalism. Anti-Federalist Paper 17. Sentinel didn't think that a separation of powers could be achieved under the proposed Constitution. Anti-Federalist Paper 47. And Leonidas agreed with Sentinel, and that was Anti-Federalist Paper 48. I mean, there's more of them, but it kind of repeats the same idea. I think maybe just one more real quickly. One writer by the pseudonym of Deliberator thought that the implications of Congress's enumerated powers were way too much, Anti-Federalist Paper 44. So this was something I kept seeing over and over again in the Anti-Federalist Papers, was that they thought that the proposed federal constitution that was to replace the Articles of Confederation, which were in operation up until the time of the Philadelphia Convention, basically increased the powers of government from the limited government of the first American Confederacy to this greater, to what they saw as this greater, more centralized behemoth that pretended to be limited, but in fact was not? I mean, do you think those anti-federalists were exaggerating
Well,
in terms of expressing their concerns?
the Supremacy Clause 118 definitely is ambiguous as hell because it's been interpreted to broaden the powers, the Incorporation Doctrine, the 14th Amendment, and the Article 187, 1818 are the rationalizations, not justifications, but rationalizations for what the government does quite a bit of now. Now, as far as some of the other comments that you read, those are opinions, because if it worked the way it was supposed to, now let's talk about two things that address how it's supposed to work. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect confederation of states. And again, back to Federalists and Anti-Federalists, the Anti-Federalists wanted a confederation, the Union. And that's in here. It says a more perfect Union. And it was that was resolving a lot of the problems inherent in the Articles of Confederation. Establish justice, but where's the justice now? The Department of Justice is a massive paddling people, putting them in prison that they disagree with, and in other cases, ignoring laws completely. Ensure domestic tranquility. Well, how do you do that? You have a comfortable environment where the states don't compete with each other, and that would include, say, the proper application of the Commerce Clause. Provide for the common defense. There we've talked about that, the Army and the Navy and the militia. Promote the general welfare. Now, here's a tough one because the government seems to have left general out. But if you look at definitions back then, the general welfare is creating an environment within a country where everybody's comfortable, which means you don't have an overbearing tyrannical government, among other things. But it doesn't mean welfare, giving things away. And secure the blessings of liberty. Now, what is liberty? That's where my fist stops at your nose. That means I can live my life. Right? So let's go now to the Bill of Rights, and let's look at Article 9 and 10, the two most significant. These were not rights given, they were rights retained, not enumerated rights, let me put it that way. 9, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. That would mean that all the rights we retained in 1820 are still our rights, correct?
Well, at least those that are recognized, because obviously there are others that are not recognized by the government, so.
The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So anything that wasn't taken from us by the Constitution is retained by us. That's the intent. It's ignored now.
Right. I mean, the Bill of Rights really only recognizes pre-existing natural liberty that the people enjoy, that absence of servitude and restraint, which is what liberty is.
Right, but we're past that absence of liberty and restraint, aren't we? I mean, we're restrained all the time.
Yeah, there's servitude
from
all
every
the
level
time,
of
yeah.
government. Every level yeah. of government. The direct taxes now being an annual affair with regular increases, diminishing our purchasing power drastically. We had the right to retain our property, and they're taking our property away. If I earn something, I can buy property with it, or I can give it to the government. So they're stealing my property with direct taxes, not applied as intended by the founders, but not written into the document, unfortunately, but expressed in at least 5 states during the convention. Let's look at the other one. The powers not delegated to the United States, the powers, not rights this time, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, and that's Article 1, Section 10, are reserved to the states respectively or the people. But that's gone by the wayside too, because they have gone, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution. What powers were delegated? 1, 8, and the prohibitions are 1-9. And the state prohibited the states are 1-10. So if these were adhered to rigidly, but they've been lost for years. You know, we talked about that in the last BEL. These things have been abused. The intent is quite clear, because as it existed then, so shall it be now, but it ain't what it was then. In either the relationship to the states or and the powers of government, or in relation to the rights retained by the people. So again, the clarification wasn't there, but if the Constitution were revised to be more explicit and draw those lines rigidly, Commerce Clause is ambiguous. 1-8-18 is ambiguous. What is necessary for government? Well, you know, to most wives, new shoes are necessary every month. Wait, they're not necessary to the husband, but they are to the wife, right? So the government has construed necessary as whatever they think they need, rather than absolutely necessary for the conduct of government.
Well,
now let's get checks and balances, separation of power too. Let's go there. Who makes laws in the federal level?
It's supposed to be the United States Congress pursuant to Article 1.
Okay, and who administers the laws of the United States?
The laws are supposed to be enforced by the Executive Office of the President pursuant to Article 2.
And who determines the when a dispute exists between those two?
It is supposed to be the federal judiciary and the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court specifically, pursuant to Article 3.
Right, and generally that contest is brought by, as in Marbury versus Madison, is brought by one of those, the first or second branch of government, where they disagree on interpretation. When we go beyond that, that court is not to write law based on a lawsuit by individuals, but then we've got Ashwander versus TVA, where they decided that they would branch out into areas, and the case law method from the 1870s have decided that they can branch out beyond the authority granted them by the Article 3 of the Constitution. Now, is there a separation of powers? Well, in a recent event with Kim Davis, we find out that the lowest level of court can put somebody in jail in contempt because a higher level court had made a decision in the Obergefell case that the states had no right to decide what marriage is within their states. They've taken away a right that existed for 240 years within the states and said, you can't do that anymore. We will decide. Now, did they give it to Congress and say, you've got to change your laws? In the statutes of the United States, hold on a second, I've got to get that article. No, I can't reach it from here. But in U.S. Code, and the number I don't have, but we'll link it in, it says that for the purpose of government, paraphrasing, only a marriage between a man and a woman will be recognized by any government agency. Still there. I checked the other day. Kentucky Constitution 223A, Section 223A says a marriage is only between a man and a woman. The statutes in Kentucky say the same thing. So this low-level judge, based on a Supreme Court decision, has changed the law to the point of being punitive to somebody who swore to uphold the laws of the United States and Pennsylvania as her duties. So this court then has washed asunder one federal statute, one state constitution, and one state statute. Now, properly, and if we look back in history, when something like that happened, then the legislative body, those passing the laws, had the responsibility then, and this has happened with a good example is death penalty laws. What did the states do right after the Supreme Court ruled on death penalty? They go back and revisit their laws and rewrite them to be in conformance with the decision of the Supreme Court. But in the case of marriage, the United States government, the Congress of the United States, has not revised their section on marriage. The Kentucky legislature has not revised it. And if states are guaranteed a Republican form of government, how in hell can a judge or even the Supreme Court tell a state that its constitutional amendment is not constitutional without giving explicit federal authority to deal with the issue of marriages? So, separation of powers? Ain't none. Everybody walks over, everybody in each of the branches get what they want. The executive branch doesn't enforce some laws, and it enforces others, and it enforces others by misinterpretation of those laws. The Congress is more concerned with passing legislation for their friends, corporations, so that they get money in their re-election coffers than they are with the people themselves. So separation of powers does not exist. All three branches are willing to acquiesce to one for the other, but the one that's coming out senior, which back in 1810 was the one most likely to protect our liberties, is now the one most detrimental to our liberties. And the reason I say that about 1810, there were a number of writings back then talking specifically about which one can we rely on the most for making a fair judgment in matters of contest within the government. Well, the legislators want to get reelected, and there have always been their cronies. The executive wants to get reelected, and he's got his cronies. But the Supreme Court was specifically for life on good behavior, and was appointed by the president with the consent of the Senate, assuming they would have no outside obligations that would impair their fair judgment of a matter before them. But we don't have that anymore, so that separation of powers that expected the judiciary to be the most protective of our rights has become the most destructive beyond the Congress and far beyond the executive branch of government. Checks and balances, separation of powers, non-existent.
Well, are we more oppressed now by our constitutional republic than our ancestors were by the British Empire?
No. We are. Let me rephrase your question. Are we more oppressed now by our government? Let me put, you know, I don't like adjectives, but I'm going to put one in here. By our tyrannical government than our ancestors were by the British Empire. 20-fold. Yes. Not the constitutional republic, but the government. Now, hey, we're back to Locke, aren't we? Full circle. It's the government, not the constitutional republic. The government has no semblance to the Constitution. The Constitution has no semblance of the government. Am I correct?
Well, it's the current federal government, and hell, I'll even go to the next step and say the several state governments, and definitely Texas,
okay,
where
I'll go with the federal government, the tyrannical federal government. As long as we've got tyrannical, you could put federal in there, but yes, the government.
Okay.
States, do they follow Big Brother in their application? Hell yes, they always have. They used to stay out of debt pretty much. States didn't go into debt unless there was a disaster, like, you know, the Dust Bowl in the 30s, and different things can have an enormous impact on a state. But for the most states, the states were physically responsible for most of their history. And so, again, we're going to go back to the 1960s and the civil rights movement and the proliferation of welfare and taking over, government taking over the concept of charity and making it rigid, unforgiving, and unproductive. And that's where most state debt comes in. California used to have the best roads in the world when I got out of the Army in the late 60s, because these things were just transitional, beginning to come into play. But now, when they tried to get an increase in gas tax a few years ago, they specified in the amendment how every 40% of the gas tax has to be designated for maintenance of the roads. But it used to be a done deal. The gas tax went to the roads. It didn't go anywhere else. But general funding allowed them to take the gas tax money and give it to people who weren't willing to work for a living. So the state governments have followed the dictates of the federal government. They've done it another way, the one that I've described in an article called Green Mail, where they actually send more money back to the states via funding than they raised from those states in taxation, income tax, corporate tax, and all that. If we take all the tax that comes out of, say, Texas, your state, the federal government gives almost, I think in Texas, they give almost as much back, not counting the collection and redistribution costs, to Texas. But then they tell Texas what they have to do. You have to have a welfare program. You got to give these people unwilling to work money.
So yeah, the power of the purse.
Power of the purse. And so the and there's no reason for taxation, because the federal government, not counting collection and administration, actually sends more back to the states, or did in 2005, than they collected from the states. So the federal government is collecting these back to direct taxes to buy the favor of states. And then states are caught up in, we'll give you $100 million for a road project, but you got to match the funds. So now the state's got to come up with $100 million that they didn't want to spend, didn't need to spend. This little town I live in, $7 million to put in curbs for about a little less than a half a mile. And, oh, we've got some really nice planters, both in the sidewalk and intruding into the parking lanes of the road. And we've got some beautiful bricked third lane, center lanes, and crosswalks. This little farming community's got $7 million worth of shovel-ready projects from, you know, what they called it a few years ago. What a waste of money. No wonder the states are broke. Because if they want the federal money, they've got to match their share of the funds and do projects that are absolutely unnecessary. So the states are just following the lead, and the families are following the same lead. They're spending money, you know, how about this reverse mortgage, you know? Why not, you know, they used to pass the house on to the children, but now they indebt the house, and the reverse mortgage, the mortgage company is actually buying the house from them at a great loss, I might add, and taking away what used to be passed on, the inheritance that used to be passed on to our children. So the even families that fall for that, and the government gives some tax breaks for it too, by the way, to encourage it. But the families in many cases are even following this perpetual debt aspect of fiscal responsibility that the federal government, then the state government, and now the family government practices. And their credit card debts. I mean, I've got a son that has more credit card debt, or had at one point, more than he was making in a year before taxes. And he's still struggling to get out of it. He bought something with reduced payments for 2 years. But once the 2 years was up, the reduced interest for 2 years. Once the reduced interest 2 years was up, it went up to 22% from 12%. And so now when he makes a payment, he's paying interest only, just like the federal government does, just like the state governments do. They pay interest only to keep from going into bankruptcy. So, you know, unfortunately, when the federal government does, it will either be adopted by or forced upon or a combination of the two, the state government. And now having this beautiful model in front of us, we know we can live better electrically by indebting our grandchildren. You know, the house is gone. The children have to bear the expense upon the demise of the parents and to bury them and everything. So it just, everything's not the way it should be. And it could be if we had stuck to the minimum government. Jefferson said it, the Jeffersonian concept of government, the most important government is that one closest to us. The Elements of Civil Government, 1891, the book that I think you may have read it, it's on my library, explains what government was 120 years ago. It was, you wouldn't think it was the same country if you read that. They talk about the most important government is your family. Next is your church, if you're religious. Next is your school district, which you controlled, not the federal government, not the state government. Next was the city, then the county. I think I've got the order correct. Then the state, and then the federal. The federal should, for most people would never have dealings with the federal government in their whole life 200 years ago. And now we can't get away with dealings with the federal government.
Well, couldn't we just reverse the tyranny we suffer under by amending the Constitution, just as what was done to repeal the prohibition of alcohol?
Yeah, there are two methods of amending the Constitution. One requires Congress to submit by two-thirds majority, submit to the states an amendment to the Constitution, and then three-quarters of the states ratify it. Then it becomes a part of the Constitution. You think Congress is going to do that to take away their powers? That was a question mark on the end of that.
Yeah, probably not.
Oh, I'm a little more sure than that, that absolutely not, because it would take away their powers. Their philanthropical nature. So the other method is for the states to do it. Now, what would happen? You know, people have been trying to get, they call them, refer to them con-cons rather than am-cons. I think AmCon Amendment Convention would be more appropriate. But one, even though there have been 120 or more calls, they're dispersed over time. And it makes sense that if somebody calls for one now, you can't do 10 years later, somebody else calls for one, start counting that for the requisite number because you've changed legislative bodies. But they didn't define in that enough to really resolve how it functions. So sometimes they call for a convention without specifics. And Wikipedia, if you look up constitutional or Constitutional Amendment Convention, I think it is, you'll see the calls that have been made, and they have a purpose. They might have two purposes, but there's got to be coincidence to satisfy the amendment just from a common sense standpoint, and they've never had that coincidence, and they've never had even one quarter of the states involved in a single issue. And people keep trying to push these, and you know, it's almost an unworkable aspect. It might have been workable back when there were 16, 17, maybe even 20 states, but with 50 states, it's almost unworkable because the divide, the very divide, the amendment process to correct the evils of government almost out of the question. And then the other question, if the states did come together, what would be the effect on the federal government's distribution of funds if the states started talking about correcting something that would take away that federal power? Hey, we're going to stop your funding then. And education is a good example. Education used to be supported primarily by local funding taxation, supplemented by the state revenues. But now the federal government is the primary funder of schools, and I think the rate last time I looked about 3 years ago was $55 a student day. So every day a student attends, the school gets $55, or the school district gets $55. So the federal government has absolute power over the schools, and the schools have absolute power over Common Core. And Common Core apparently seems to think that Allah had something to do with that because Allah is the only God or something like that. So how can you change it? The schools go along with it because they want the money. And they're teaching a foreign religion in a nation who was founded on Judeo-Christian values. And they're teaching math that's incomprehensible.
So
it's not going to change by the amendment process.
Okay, well, in that case then, so is an Article 5 convention desirable or even possible at this point?
You know, I've withheld judgment on that. Something happened in April 1975, and Sam Adams' possible comment, historically relevant comment, was, "What a wonderful day." And I don't think he was talking about the weather. If we had a constitutional convention, it would be interesting to see what the states did. And if they started shifting against the people, and we're looking at amendments that would give more power to the states or more power to the federal government, then it's time to pick up the rifles. If they shifted the other way and looked at amendments that would correct some of these things, then it could be a good thing. But I can't predict the future. I can't predict how they act. So I refuse to judge on that. I will say it is possible that a convention of a Fifth Amendment convention possibly could correct some of the evils. But are they going to spend a year there or 2 years there going through this whole thing and drawing these lines that are necessary to curtail federal authority? Or are they going to go in for a specific purpose and or a couple purposes and deal with a couple, let's call them what they are, relatively insignificant issues? Because if you just take a little piece here and a little piece there, the rest remains. And believe me, there was an amendment to the Constitution that was first submitted along with the Bill of Rights. It was ratified about 20 years ago, called the 27th Amendment. And so the idea back 200 years ago was that if Congress increases their compensation, that it will not go into effect until the next Congress. Now, Congresses are 2 years in duration. So if it was passed in the 89th Congress, it would not go into effect in the 90th Congress. Good reasoning behind this, because if they passed themselves a raise, the people found out and then didn't think it was justified, they wouldn't send those idiots back to Congress for the 90th Congress. 89th would have been their last. However, what happened with the 27th Amendment? And this is how divisive the federal government is, the Congress especially. Congress, when they saw that it was close to getting ratified, they said, let's pass a law that says we get a raise every year unless we vote down that raise. So they did. And then the amendment was ratified. And so they get their raise every year, regardless of what the amendment says, unless they decide to turn it down. Now, some congressmen and some private citizens decided to challenge that law that they'd enacted before the amendment at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said they didn't have standing to challenge a law that was passed before the amendment. So Congress gets their pay raise every year unless they vote it down, regardless of the wording of the 27th Amendment that says if they vote themselves a raise, they're following the letter of the law. And this is, again, symptomatic of the whole Constitution. They're following the letter of the law as they interpret it. We're not voting ourselves a raise. We've got it already. So that amendment, when ratified, was moot. It had no way to play. It was impossible to apply because they had already voted perpetual raises for themselves. So if we look at an amendment convention, I hope the people in the convention are better at wording than the founding fathers were, because the founding fathers' words, whether it be the 27th Amendment or the entire Constitution, have been circumvented to the point that they're out of effect. And my answer to that question when you asked if we're oppressed by our constitutional republic, no. It doesn't have anything to do with the oppression. De facto authority presumed under that Constitution is how the government operates, but it's not under that government any more than the 27th Amendment has any effect at all on passing a pay raise in Congress. Your turn.
Well, I was just thinking about what you said, and you know, there was this issue during the ratification period, especially considering the attitude of the Federalists being take this or nothing, as how they kind of were trying to sell the people and the state conventions on the attractiveness of their proposed constitution. One anti-Federalist who went by the handle of An Old Whig commented on the Article 5 power of holding constitutional conventions when he said, quote, "If the principles of liberty are not firmly fixed and established in the present Constitution, in vain may we hope for retrieving them hereafter. The greater the abuse of power, the more obstinately it is always persisted in," close quote. And that's taken from Anti-Federalist Paper 49. So do you think that An Old Whig was on the ball there?
Well, I think I said that before. If they had adhered to the Constitution as the Federalists presented it, and especially with the inclusion of the Bill of Rights, and not tried to circumvent the intent, and we've discussed a number of those circumventions, where the 27th Amendment, Commerce Clause, and some others, it would be fine. But okay, we got pessimists and optimists. The anti-federalists were pessimists about the Constitution. But what you said about take it or leave it, how else can you do a Constitution when it's done by the body of the people? If it's a select group, an oligarchy, and they're going to set up a Constitution, they hash it out around the table, which is basically what happened in Philadelphia. They hash it out until it's satisfied. But here, in this case, we had the wisdom of this country. We had most of the wisdom of this country in that hall in Philadelphia. Take it or leave it. Yeah, that's it. I've got a horse for sale, and it's $200. You say you want to pay $150. Take it or leave it. There are many things that have to be take it or leave it. Let's suppose that the Constitution was drawn up and it was sent to all the states, and they said, well, which parts do you want and which parts do you don't want? And some wanted these and don't want these, others want these and don't want those. The slavery issue would have been a rather interesting one. Now, how do we reconcile that between Congress and between the Senate and the House of Representatives, when either one proposes a bill, the other one has a similar bill, but then the amendments here on one house and amendments in the other house, they have to be reconciled. And that can take months quite often, if you go back to the Congressional Globe and look at a lot of the dealings of government back then, these things go, and I haven't looked recently at the Congressional Record to see how they do this, but they've got to reconcile that so that both parties agree to vote on the same thing. Otherwise, it can't be a law. What's the president going to do? Sign the one of his choice? No, because Congress has to give him one piece of paper to sign or veto, or let come into law without action. So, with the Constitution, they throw it out. One state wants this, one wants that. Say, on one issue, you might have four or five different ideas on what should be done. And so how do you reconcile that? How many years would it take? And would the country go broke before it got done? Remember, they were facing bankruptcy. They had France and Holland primarily that they owed millions of dollars to. The whole thing was falling apart. New York was taxing goods that were on their way to New Jersey because they docked at New York, Commerce Clause type situation. States were ready to leave the Union because they couldn't get anything done. I think New York was the one that kept the commerce provision they were trying to put in place from passing, but there were obstructions all the way through this thing because it took a unanimous vote. That was problematic. So now we've got this constitution, but are we going to throw it out until everybody's satisfied? What if three quarters of them are satisfied with these 17 provisions and three quarters overlapping three quarters are satisfied with those 22 provisions and another three quarters are satisfied with these 16 provisions? But we don't have three quarter unanimity on the whole thing. So once it's broken up, it becomes almost impossible to get the requisite 9 out of 13. Basically, it was a three-quarter concept, but they said 9. So it would have been impossible to create a new government at that point. Virtually impossible, just statistically and mathematically impossible, because of the diverse interests, especially then because of the agricultural South and the industrial North.
Well, might state citizenship gradually restore the republic by itself, and more specifically, be attempts of people to try and cast off their legal status as United States citizens, 14th Amendment subjects, in other words, in favor of being, say, for instance, Illinoisans, Virginians, Floridians, Californians, Montanans, Texans, and so on.
Okay, what provision in the Constitution would be the only one that would really work to achieve that?
Probably the Comity Clause.
No. 192.
Okay.
To challenge jurisdiction or unconstitutional laws, very clearly stated by legal scholars even after the formation of this country. How else could you establish it? But what? Wait. Only Congress can suspend it, but you can't get it heard. Do you think government is going to recognize that? Do you think the judicial system is capable of addressing that problem? Do you think that the judges or the members of the Department of Justice in the attorney's office would submit to allowing that to happen because they've got control, they've got power now, and they go wherever they want to? If it could function, if it could be put into place, which is what I've been trying to do for 3 years now with habeas corpus to challenge those laws, then it could, but the impracticality, I think, has been clearly demonstrated by the appellate court in Georgia, the district court in Florida, the Florida Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, the Montana District Court, and perhaps even the circuit court in California, which is over Montana, that we ain't going to get there from here unless it's at the point of a bayonet. So, it's state citizenship, and I've said this for years, it's a state of mind that you need to understand before you realize that things have gotten serious in this country. State citizenship is a way of understanding what you should have. And I've understood that for over 20 years. But
yeah, I think,
beyond
I think
that,
you've...
the application does not exist.
Yeah, I think you've mentioned that in the past previously, so I guess it would be more accurate to say that it's more philosophical, not practical.
It's not philosophical, and it's not practical. It's a state of mind that you must have. Let's put it this way. You're a pole vaulter, and they just moved it up to 18 feet, and the highest you've ever done 16, and you look at it and say, I can do 18. No, I don't think I can do 18.
Mm.
Oh, that's awful tough. I don't think I can do 18. Do you think you'll do 18 when you believe you can't do it? Do you?
Fair enough.
Okay. Now, yeah. If I want to reestablish the Constitution where state citizens are recognized as subordinate to the state government, not the federal government, I've got to realize the reality, or not the reality, but the absolute necessity and the significance and the fact that the Constitution recognizes that status. Now I can get 18 feet. But
well,
if I don't believe that, I ain't going to get there. So it's a state of mind. is not a philosophy, because it's a tangible reality, but it's only going to be achieved if we're willing to fight for it. And that's not philosophical. Locke was philosophical. That's not. That's a reality that should exist.
Well, speaking of fighting, is there a peaceful solution that would result in restoration of constitutional government?
You know, that's a question that I've heard since probably 1981 or 82, when I first got involved with what the then Patriot community, which was primarily tax protests, people protesting illegal taxes, that more manifest than after 1993. Is it possible this is a peaceful solution? No. But most people think there is, so they're calling for this something, I forgot what they call it now. Right now, the big move on an Article 5 commitment is Contraband Amendment or something like that. First, they'll never get the convention together, and second, I doubt that they'd ever get it passed, because the federal government probably threatened withholding funds if the state legislatures ratified it. Voting, that's real successful. I remember the first Tea Party batch was about 80 people, and about 60 voted for the extension of NDAA. And I read an article about one of them saying, when we got to Washington, the Republican Party brought us into their luncheons and their dinners and their cocktail parties and made us feel like parts of the family. And so they went along with them. They saw them as the seniors and listen to them. So you had about a third of these guys actually voted against NDAA when the Tea Party platform was against NDAA. So voting ain't going to work, but how long is it going to get people to realize that we have a one-party system with two factions in that party? Trump is getting away from political correctness, and he's talking about hard facts, what we need, hard love, some people call it. This is reality, and he's the only one. Now, others are having to bend. Look at the effect he's had. They're now illegal immigrants. They used to be undocumented illegal aliens. They used to be undocumented immigrants or undocumented workers, but more and more mainstream media is falling back on that. Perhaps there is a peaceful solution, but I would think that Congress will probably, if Trump's elected, Trump will probably get anything he vetoes will get overridden like they did with Andrew Johnson. So possibly Trump, who is a businessman and would run the case, we might get somewhere. Now with Trump, we've got a rather unique situation. Back in the 1850s and 1860, election of 1860 in particular, an existing party was turned around completely, and Abraham Lincoln was the candidate for that party. So that was one of a few times in our history there's been a major change in a political party. And it is possible with Trump in there that the Republican Party, or the majority of them, will adhere to the idea that the people should determine the platform rather than the dictates, as we've had for decades, of those behind the scenes, behind the curtain in the Republican Party that have their people out dictating what policy will be, and the people adhering to that, that the floor cry might be, we want this. And, right now with Trump, it is possible that we could go back to a two-party system. I don't know if it'll work or not, but if it does, it's just going to turn the Republican Party around. Frequently, that comes with a name change as well. But when you look at even the Republican Party is running ads now condemning Trump, through PACs that are associated with the Republican Party. So, is there a possibility of a peaceful solution? There's one other option for a peaceful solution, and we've discussed it before. It's called habeas corpus, because the Founding Fathers felt to put a right, embody a right in the Constitution, not in the Bill of Rights, that was intended, historically, the scholars say, even after the formation of this country, to challenge federal overreach in regards to both jurisdiction To deal with unconstitutional laws. Is that going to work? I don't know. I put a lot of effort into it, and I would love to see a peaceful solution, but I'm not sure that it can happen. So that leaves us in a quandary. Now, while we were discussing that, I was looking for something because I think this is pretty significant to understand. And this has to do with the ratification of the Constitution. We've talked a little earlier about that. But, you know, people think it was sectional, but it wasn't. This is the order of ratification of the Constitution and the votes within the conventions. Delaware was the first to ratify December 7th, 1787. 30 ayes and no noes, or nays. So it was unanimous. Pennsylvania was next with 46 ayes and 23 noes. That was 2-1. New Jersey, 38 yeas and zero nays, unanimous. Georgia, so see, we've got New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, northern states, very strong on it. Pennsylvania, the weakest one, the other three, the other two unanimous. Georgia, however, a southern state, unanimous, 26-0. Connecticut, 128-40, so we've got about a 3-1 on that. Massachusetts, 187-168, and they're about the closest state as far as passage, but they still had a comfortable majority. Maryland was 63-11. South Carolina, 149-73, 2-1. New Hampshire, 57-46. Virginia, 89-79. New York, 30-27. That was fairly close. North Carolina, 184-77. And Rhode Island, finally. And Rhode Island didn't ratify until after the Bill of Rights was submitted to the states for ratification. And that was 34-32. It was a very close one as well. So, see, it wasn't sectional. Perhaps how well the argument was presented, because we can't see, you know, agricultural and industrial having big differences on that. But as far as a peaceful solution, back to the question you asked, maybe, but if we wait for it, you know, we've got, what, a year and 2 months to the election. And if we wait for it, how much worse is this country going to be off? And what if we if Trump doesn't win the election? Where are we going to be then? If Trump gets assassinated, where are we going to be then? So if there is a peaceful solution, that doesn't preclude us from pursuing whatever means necessary, back to the Declaration of Independence, whatever means necessary to restore constitutional government in this country. And we can hope that before bloodshed or before it gets too serious that things can change. But once blood begins getting shed on a large scale, just like April 1975, there is no turning back at one point. As much as people hoped that it could turn back, and some persisted, well, we can reconcile, but at that point there is no reconciliation. So that's the answer to that question.
Well, why is adherence to restoring the Constitution so important then?
Because of the great experiment and the fact that we, like they, will be starting with their clean sheet of paper with words on it. But we will be in a position to see where the chicanery got around, circumvented the Constitution, and then draw in the words that prohibit that from happening again. They had a blank sheet. They could not anticipate both the technological changes and the divisiveness of certain people that want to hold greater power than was granted to them. So by adhering to the Constitution, we're starting from a beautiful foundation that existed for 80 years prior to the Civil War. Should we start over when it works so beautifully for nearly a century? Or should we go back to that point in time and determine what their intent was and draw those lines with more verbiage? You know, we created a government with little over 4,000 words, and we've got laws today where a single law, a single bill, can be tens of thousands of words. So in forming the country, perhaps we need a few more words to get the to define those lines. I can think of no better place to start than with that document because of its initial success.
Well, just to kind of follow up on that then, what would you say to the concept that the Constitution has either authorized such a government as we have had or has been powerless to prevent it?
Well, it's been powerless because they have ignored the wording in the Constitution. They created a fourth branch of government by their own admission, and that fourth branch of government is not bound by the Constitution. They have their own courts, their own judicial system. A good example, the IRS comes after you. You have to prove your innocence. They don't have to prove your guilt. They just make the accusation. There are other places where you're guilty when the, especially with administrative agencies, you're guilty, and the burden is on you to prove your innocence. That's not the way it's supposed to be. The government's supposed to have an overwhelming case against you and be able to prove that. Your defense could be nothing because they have to prove that you're guilty. And, you know, one good example is the Branch Davidian trial over the events in Waco back in 1993. I talked to Sarah Bain, the jury forewoman, after the verdict came out, and they found them guilty of use of firearms in commission of a crime. And I asked her, what crime did they commit? She said, well, we didn't determine there was any crime except use of the firearms in a crime. And then she said, I understand that sounds strange, but all the effort the government put into it and all the charges they brought against the Davidian, we felt they had to find them guilty of something, so we took the one that was the lowest punishment, and we found them guilty of that. And if that wasn't enough, then the judge upped by 5 years. I think it was 7 years that they would have been the conviction. But the judge arbitrarily upped it 5 years to 12 years because he said the weapons were automatic. So, you know, is there justice in that? The Davidians, by their defense, proved that they did not commit a crime, because the jury could not find a crime, but they were still convicted of possession of firearms and the commission of a, or use of firearms in the commission of a crime. That's, you know, it's a small one, but there are hundreds of situations like this. I mean, if we look at the people in prison now, how many were determined to be guilty? Look at the jury selection process where the last time I was going to serve on jury duty, one of the, it was in Phoenix, Arizona, and it was, you know, county matter. The question was, one of the questions that was proffered to all the jurors was, do you believe the law enforcement officer will always tell the truth on the stand? Well, anybody that answered yes to that, have you been a juror before? Just questions, just to pass the time. But anybody that answered no to that question was given a third degree. They would find some reason to remove them from the jury pool. So, you know, we've got to, things aren't working the way they're supposed to. We've got less than the colonists had under King George III.
Well, Gary, I mean, I really appreciate you kind of taking the time and really kind of examining the Constitution pretty much virtually line by line. And not only that, but also trying to judge its, at least to some degree, its efficacy. And the one thing I was kind of just thinking of is was something that, Ludwig von Mises, who was a classical liberal and an Austrian economist, once said, which was that liberty is always freedom from the government. And I think that if we're going to be advocates of liberty, then I think that kind of bears keeping in mind. So
So
I think what you've had to offer really is really some serious food for thought.
it is, and that liberty being, I mean, that's an aspect of liberty, but that's paramount in terms of our relationship with the federal government, and that was written into the Constitution as intended, but not as applied today. So that reversion back to the Constitution and the clarification of the limits upon government would achieve that liberty with regard to the federal government. That doesn't deal with the state governments, but if the federal government were to step back and take their proper role, I think it would be easy for the states to follow.
Well, Gary, again, I just really feel blessed that you've really spent this time with me and to really just figure out what is this Constitution thing, what is it, what does it have to offer, and really it's efficacy. And I think it's kind of obvious what I think that would is that is. And I think it's also good for other people to kind of hear what it's got to offer. And so again, I thank you very much. I
Well,
appreciate it.
let me add one more thing. You've read Lysander Spooner, The Constitution of
No trees in the Constitution of no authority.
right. And he criticized the Constitution. He criticized the fact that he wasn't given the opportunity to ratify it. He had all these complaints. And one thing he did not offer, however, was an alternative, a solution to the problem that he posed. And so when we consider that and we look at the Constitution, unless and until somebody can propose a better system, especially based on consideration of what I've suggested over and over again, that we go back and draw those lines very rigidly, and until somebody offers an alternative to that, their argument is of no consequence.
Well, that's definitely something to consider, absolutely. So, again, thank you very much for really examining what this Constitution is and what it's composed of and its original intent and how the government, as it stands, or at least that which it purports to be the government, has infringed on it so unbelievably that it might as well be a foreign government at this point.
Yes. Well, you're welcome, Sleepy, and as always, it's a pleasure to sit down and talk with you and help digest and consolidate my thoughts on a subject because it just makes me more articulate as time goes on in talking about these things. I get the pieces and I put them together to some degree, but when we have a discussion like this, it really helps to sort those out, isolate the individual pieces, and so it improves me as well as hopefully you in the process of doing this.
I think so. Well, good night.
Night.